This podcast is brought to you by Podcast Nation.
Welcome to The Real Reel, where I take you behind the Instagram reel and into the real lives of entrepreneurs, content creators, and anyone who inspires me and may inspire you too. I'm your host, Natalie Barbu, and let's get into it.
Founders need to not have ego so many times, right? Like, you need to be willing to wake up one morning, realize that everything you've been doing is just wrong, and just start again. And do it almost emotionless and not sad about it, because it's part of the journey. You'll have to do it so many times. So it's almost a struggle with yourself and the way you're wired, because we're all like a little bit different, and so many of our weaknesses are just so hard to deal with. But it's almost like you need to have so much self-awareness of what those weaknesses are, and not lean to those, but fully lean to the strengths, and just make sure that you're always moving forward.
Hi everyone, and welcome back to the Real Real podcast. I am finally home from Mexico, and I am happy to report that it didn't thunderstorm every single day. It actually was pretty good weather. The first 2 days that we were there, it was a little gray and cloudy, and I'm not gonna lie, it was a little chilly. There were many moments where I did not want to get into the pool because it was just so cold, because there was like no sun at all and it was very cloudy, but it didn't really thunderstorm. It stormed for about few minutes, maybe an hour for the first 2 days. And then after that, it was actually pretty good weather. So I'm not going to complain about it. It was so much better than I could have asked for. And I was just very, very happy that it didn't, you know, storm the entire time. So it was actually a really, really great trip. And it was one of those trips that was super, super relaxing. And I was actually able to unplug for the most part. So I thought that that was really nice. And if you have no idea what I'm talking about, if you listened to last week's episode, I was very stressed about the weather forecast, and I was going on a family vacation to Cancun. But as you guys just heard, everything was okay. And like I said, it was just a very, very good time to relax and unwind. I actually really, really, really did unplug. I feel like for the most part, I was really present. I was in the moment. I was hanging out with my family. I was hanging out with Keon. It was honestly such a great trip. And it was one of those where like we didn't have a schedule. We didn't have anything to do. The only thing that we had on the calendar was like our dinner reservations. And it was just really, really fun. I ended up vlogging a little bit of it, but I didn't pressure myself to vlog. And honestly, I'm not sure if I'm going to post it, because I feel like I didn't get that much footage and I feel like it's not going to be entertaining. So I might just, you know, post the Instagram photos and that's it. Maybe make some of the footage that I got into a TikTok. I don't really know. Really trying to get into TikTok, guys. So be sure to follow me on there. It's just one of those things. It's like, oh my gosh, it's another platform. But I know that's the direction to go, because as you guys have heard, probably Instagram is now focusing on being a video app, not a photo app. There's a lot that I feel about that. I don't like it, I will say. I think that it's actually pretty stupid. I think that Instagram should focus on being a photo app and also stay in their own lane instead of copying other apps. But you know what? That's just my two cents on it, because Instagram is going to do what they want to do. So you kind of just got to play the game and keep up, and video is where it's at. So I have to start getting into TikTok, because I'm so used to long form content that for me to get into short term content, it's like a little challenging, I guess. But nevertheless, I was really able to unplug. That was the moral of that story. And I wanted to do a high and low of the week. So my high would actually be that I was unplugging, that I was able to relax, that I was able to not work. Because when I tell you, my vacations are very, very rarely actually vacations. I feel kind of bad saying that, because it's like I have the best job where I can travel whenever I want or wherever I want. I don't have to, you know, show up at an office, but I feel like my vacations are very, very work focused and they're very work heavy, and I never really unplug fully. Like, even on airplanes, I like buy the Wi-Fi and I work on the plane, or like I always make sure that I do a little bit of work in the morning. I never ever block like full days off on my calendar. Like every single day in Mexico, I had a call, but it was only like one call or two calls a day, so it wasn't bad. But you know, I never feel like I can actually take time off for myself. And even though I did have those like one or two calls, I truly was able to unplug. I wasn't on my laptop at all. I took the calls on my phone. Like, it was actually a very, very, very nice trip. And it's one of those things that I usually don't have. Like, I really never have that. I mean, the next trips that I have, I'm going to New York City next week, which I am so excited about. I cannot wait to be back in New York. I feel like I miss her so much. I really, really do. I feel like I could cry thinking about New York City, but I'm going back next week and like it's going to be fully work mode. You know, I'm trying to get as much done as I can. And like anytime I, you know, travel to LA, it's fully work mode. If I go home, I'm still working, you know, so it was really nice. It was really nice not to be on my laptop. I did feel stressed, but it was okay. It was a good, relaxing trip. And I highly encourage anyone, if you feel overworked, if you feel like you can never take time off, I really think that it's important and it recharges you and it re-energizes you. And it's honestly probably better for your productivity in the long run rather than like getting burnt out. I talked about this a little bit on my Instagram. I posted a picture of Isla Mujeres. It was like one of the prettiest islands that I've been on, but posted a picture there and I kind of talked about how I was, you know, unplugged and I was resting and I was relaxed and I just felt really guilty. Like I really, really felt guilty about doing that. And I was like, but that's okay because I'm avoiding burnout. You know, like I don't want to be burnt out and then not be able to work for a while or feel, you know, completely out of control and not able to like take control of my own life and take time off if I need it. So I think it's actually really healthy to do. And I highly encourage anyone to do that if they're feeling like, you know, you can't take a break. Like you absolutely can. I really do believe that. I feel like hustle culture is like too toxic sometimes, where it's like telling you that you can never take a break, you can never take time off, you can never take time for yourself or for the people that love you, and you really can. So that was my high, was actually feeling, you know, rested and relaxed. And then I would say that my low this week was that my AC was broken when we got back. I didn't have AC for about 3 days. And I live in Miami, so the weather here is hot. It is very hot. It is 85 degrees and humid at all times. So for it to be 85 and humid outside, it's not even like opening a window would have made it any better. So for 3 days, thankfully I was with Keon, but we didn't have AC. And my AC is like pretty old, but I don't know. There was something with the compressor that was broken. I'm not going to get into the logistics because, you know, that's just so boring and I don't even really fully understand what it was. But thankfully Keon was here and I feel bad saying that because he's like, oh, so you're happy that we suffered together? And I was like, honestly, yes. Like, I know that might sound selfish, but I would rather have you here than be alone. I feel like being alone would have sucked. I would have been hot and miserable. At least we kind of like made a day out of it. You know, like we went out, we did stuff. We didn't want to be in our apartment. So it was really fun. But that was a very, very, very low point, I guess. I felt so miserable. Like I always sleep with the covers on. Like I'm one of those people that like I cannot sleep without sleeping underneath the covers, but I just like couldn't sleep underneath the covers because it was 81 degrees inside my apartment. So just picture that. That is what the thermostat read. It was 81 to 82 degrees for 3 whole days. So yeah, that was not very fun, but I feel like that's like not even really a low because it's all fixed now and it's all good. So we're good, but that was definitely a low of my week. And I wanted to talk about this episode. So this episode is with Gotti and I am so excited for it. I think that you guys are going to absolutely love it. And it's going to be one of your favorite episodes. So Gotti is the co-founder of the XX Accelerator program. And a lot of you guys know that my company Rella has been applying to a bunch of these programs. If you don't know, an accelerator pretty much is a program that helps accelerate the growth of your startup in a way. So pretty much they have like weekly courses. They bring in professionals that have already been there, done that, you know, people to guide you, people to help you. They bring in investors to kind of talk to you about what investors look at. It's pretty much like a startup course, like a crash course for startups to really accelerate the growth. But not only that, a lot of accelerators actually give you money. So I believe for the XX, they are giving you $50,000. It's an investment and they do take equity in your company. So a lot of accelerators like YC, for example, will give you, I think, $120,000, but they take 6% of your company, which to me, that's actually kind of a lot. Taking 6% of your company for $120,000 is a pretty big number. But a lot of people think like, well, when you go through an accelerator, they really help you grow quicker. You know, it automatically like values your company higher because, you know, you seem like respected or like you're established, you know, whatever. Like people, I feel like if you go through YC, your evaluation automatically goes up because people think that YC is like the best accelerator. It had things like Uber, Dropbox, Postmates, I believe. I think it was Postmates or like Instacart. You know, all of them went through YC and it's like come up with these unicorns. So people are like, oh my God, if you're a part of YC, then you're probably going to be, you know, come such a big company. And so you're like automatically evaluated at a higher rate. I feel like I'm saying really boring stuff right now, but anyways, he is the co-founder of the XX Accelerator. So that's what I was trying to get at. We have faced a lot of rejection though, I mean, with accelerator programs. So it was really amazing to hear what his company looks for in applicants. And I was definitely taking notes during this interview and I will be applying a lot of his advice to my business moving forward. Gotti was actually born and raised in Uruguay and it wasn't until he moved to the United States for college that the entrepreneurship spark was lit inside of him. In 2018, he founded XX, which is an 8-week accelerator program for founders building for the new normal. So far, they've actually accepted over 30 startups, and their goal is 20,000 startups in the next decade, which is crazy, but I think they can do it. And like I said, they offer a $50,000 investment and mentorship with experienced founders, which I just think is incredible. And they're based in San Francisco. So, you know, it's very much immersed in that startup world and the startup culture. I really want to take a trip to San Francisco, just make it a complete work trip and try to, you know, talk to as many people as I can out there. But I feel like it's super intimidating. So we'll see if I make that journey. But if any of you are from San Francisco, let me know. In this episode, we dive into how to use smart networking to cut through the noise, insider tips to stand out on your accelerator application, common mistakes that new founders make, and the personality traits every single entrepreneur needs. I know that you guys are going to absolutely love this episode. It's one that I honestly would recommend listening to multiple times, especially if you are interested in entrepreneurship or you are already into it. I think that it's one of those episodes that you need to listen to and take some notes. Honestly, I would take some notes to this episode because I think it's just super, super valuable. So without further ado, let's get into the episode. A feeling everyone listening to this has experienced is standing in front of the mirror, battling with your hair, and trying to tame the frizz before you head out. Meanwhile, you could be doing something more exciting, like booking a spontaneous getaway to, I don't know, the Caribbean or something, or binge watching the Eras Tour like I did this weekend. That's where Way's new anti-frizz cream swoops in to save the day. You are too busy to be dealing with frizz, so say hello to Way's new anti-frizz cream. It is like a magic wand for your hair, which provides immediate frizz control that lasts up to 72 hours. And if we're going to talk about hair routine, incorporating Way's anti-frizz cream into mine has literally transformed my hair. It is a time-saving superhero that fits seamlessly into my routine. And can we talk about the Sydney-inspired North Bondi scent? It is like a mini vacation every time I use it and takes me back to Australia when I went this summer. Not to mention, my hair feels lighter and looks smoother than ever before. So get busy being frizz-free with Way's new anti-frizz cream. It's not just about taming frizz. It provides heat protection up to 450 degrees. It reduces and repairs split ends, and it quenches dry hair with intense hydration. And according to a consumer perception study, 90% of participants agreed that their hair looked less frizzy after using it, so you gotta trust it. Don't forget to check out Way's other bestsellers though, like the leave-in conditioner, their detox shampoo, which I use every time I wash my hair because I can go a long time without washing my hair, fragrances, and hair oils. They are all essential for achieving that salon-worthy look at home. So frizz-free up your schedule with Way. Go to theouai.com and enter promo code REALREAL for 15% off any product. That's theouai.com, promo code REALREAL. Hi, Gotti. Thank you so much for coming on my podcast.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
I'm excited to have you on, talk about startups, talk about XX. I think it's going to be a really great episode. So before we start talking about the topics, I wanted to start setting the record straight, which is some stereotypes, some assumptions, and then you're going to tell me if they're true or false, and feel free to expand on them. So,
oh, I like that.
Yeah. So the first one is you need to raise money to start a successful startup.
I've seen a few examples that prove that's not true. Though it's definitely an exception, right? Like, I guess it depends on whether you're trying to start a startup or a business, but like a small business. But if you're really trying to grow fast, external capital can be a very powerful tool.
Yeah, I feel like bootstrapping is,
ideal in the sense that you can keep your equity and control, but it's super hard to scale. And especially in, if you're in technology or anything remotely technical, I think you really need that extra capital to grow. It's going to be really hard to scale your company at the way that you want it.
For sure. Yeah.
And then the next one is growing a business requires a lot of networking.
Perhaps smart networking for sure, because it's going to be pretty, pretty hard for you to succeed. So it's always good to have the right people alongside you.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, not the intense networking where you're just spending all of your days trying to meet new people and ultimately not focusing on building a company.
Yeah. What do you consider smart networking?
Yeah, I think it's like when you're just starting to build a company, there's 100% going to be a ton of noise.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be conference you can go to. There's going to be different events. There's going to be different people that you can meet. There's going to be investors that may be reaching out to you, different founders that are going to ask for mentorship or like a 30-minute coffee chat or stuff like that. You just got to be pretty smart that most of it will actually not add value to the company that you're building. So you need to be mindful of where you're choosing to spend your time. And many times meeting someone is very important and will help you a lot in the short term and the long term. But so many more times you're just spending your time in events, conferences that are literally meaningless and do not change anything towards the goals that you're trying to achieve.
Yeah, I actually signed up for a conference just because it was on Zoom. It was like during the pandemic. I was like, okay, I'm gonna join these events, these virtual events. And I feel like the idea is good. Like you're like, oh, I get to hear from all these founders or I can have a chance to speak to them. But I mean, I hate to say this, but it was kind of a waste of time. I was just like, I could have been doing so much more in these 12 hours that this like virtual conference was going on. And I feel like it didn't actually help that much. That's why I love listening to podcasts because I feel like I can like work and listen and still like gain value from it.
So true.
Yeah. Rather than dedicating time to like attend a conference or a virtual event.
No, absolutely.
Yeah. Do you have any events or conferences that you think are worth it though? Or do you kind of write all of them off?
I don't go to events, but I'm not an expert on events either.
Yeah.
So I'm sure there must be so many cool events there that I'm missing out on that I'm just not going to. But yeah, I don't know.
Okay. That's fine.
I have none. Yeah.
And the next one is you need a co-founder for a successful startup.
No, not at all. You don't. It's just recommended.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very lonely if you don't sometimes. You might as well try finding someone that truly resonates with what you're building and try following the journey alongside someone else.
Because mm-hmm.
Sometimes it can get pretty, pretty hard. And if you're just by yourself, it gets challenging.
Yeah, I definitely think that co-founders aren't necessarily necessary depending on what you're doing. But for a lot of people, they kind of are necessary. You know, like I think if you don't have the skills needed to start something on your own, like let's say you're starting a tech company and you don't have a technical co-founder, I don't think you're never going to succeed or anything like that, but it's a lot harder. You know, I feel like it helps. It helps a lot.
Yeah, no, in that sense, absolutely. Like for non-technical co-founders, it's always ideal if they can find a CTO. One can argue like, fine, I can just hire my first employee to be an engineer, etc. And that's true, but I don't think anyone will work as hard for your own company as another co-founder will.
Mm-hmm.
There's just some co-founders that actually have enough of all skills so that they can figure it out on their own, and many examples of companies do that, but it's still not advisable in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I agree. And were you always interested in entrepreneurship and startups, or like how did you get into this industry?
I don't think I was. So for context, I was born and raised in Uruguay. So I spent my entire life back there. And now I live in San Francisco. And if you can imagine the ecosystem there is nowhere near the experience that I've had in the US, in San Francisco specifically. So I just didn't grow up thinking about startups at all. It didn't come across. I didn't learn about them. It's definitely not an interest that has always been true. I feel like when I came to the US for college, I just started getting myself immersed in this world. Like I just started learning about it and fell in love, I guess. But I think it always was a fit with my personality. It's just like I wasn't super aware of that.
Mm-hmm. And when you came here to school, how did you kind of get into that world? Were you like joining clubs about it? Was your school heavily promoting it? Or
yeah,
what was that like?
I think it was a lot of luck. me actively trying to meet the right people. Again, I think that was true for myself as well, right? Like at the beginning, I had zero network. I didn't meet, know anyone, none of that stuff. So I started going to these events. And honestly, it just made me feel absolutely lost. It was 100% a waste of time. And then I think I had like this kind of like mindset shift, and I started just trying to meet people that I feel like would have been super interesting to meet them more personally. And I think that way I ended up meeting my first mentor. He's called James Lee. He's a founder of a Y Combinator company. And honestly, just meeting with him for like a few hours, that relationship started growing. And he honestly just showed me a world that I didn't know existed. And I think the rest is just history. I kind of like started working first at a company called WeFunder, which literally helps startups get funded. There I met hundreds of founders. I was working like everything else, just like I was part of that world already. I think that that one mentor was honestly key in what my life ended up becoming.
Yeah. How did you find him? I feel like a lot of people talk about mentors and like finding a mentor, but how did you find your mentor? Was it like a, hey, will you be my mentor? Or was it just an organic relationship that formed?
Yeah. So this is interesting because that guy writes a blog, and I had read a blog post about him, like that he wrote about how he helps people find mentors and like his tips and advice. So I was reading his blog post, and I think I kind of like very mindfully tried applying every single thing he said to him. I just met him like in this event from college. Actually, like there was this one large event where like a lot of students were meant to meet like professionals. And I remember James only went for like a few minutes at the beginning of the conference because he was doing a favor to someone else. But I knew he was going there. I was the first person to go talk to him and immediately left. So we just met some other day and kind of like it kept growing from there. I think it has to be reciprocate. He was honestly very open to helping me, very open to like listen to my struggles, my challenges back then, which were honestly pretty mundane, but still was extremely helpful. And that just kind of like started building a relationship. And from there, we just stayed in touch. And I think at this point, we're just friends.
Yeah. I feel like good advice though is finding someone, like let's say you knew that you wanted to talk to him. So you went to this place specifically to speak to him, and then you literally left. Like
100%. Like definitely. I mean, the word mentor, I don't love it necessarily. I don't know necessarily what it means. I think it's just important to understand that you want to meet people that are a few steps ahead of you in the journey that you're choosing to go through. And honestly, try clicking with them. So many of the people you'll meet that potentially may be helpful at a more personal human level, you just don't connect with. And at that point, it's kind of like pretty much useless. So you're probably going to spend a ton of time trying to meet people that you actually resonate with until you find someone that you actually want to stay in touch with. And the advice that they have to share actually makes a lot of sense for who you are and the way you're wired.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's always awkward because you want to reach out, but you don't want to just act like, okay, can I just meet with you so I can ask you a ton of questions? Because I think it needs to be somewhat of a two-way relationship. You know, it can't just be, I just want to ask you questions and that's it. And, you know, just pick your brain. Like, I feel like a lot of times for mentor and mentee relationships, it's a two-way thing, you know, like you want to actually enjoy the person. You want to actually want to help that person. You want to have a conversation. I always feel awkward just reaching out and being like, hey, let's talk so I can ask you questions. Like, I'd so much rather the first conversation, just like learn about each other before anyone asks like any technical questions or advice or anything like that.
That's so fair. I think it's like now that I'm starting to be on the other side of things and a lot of people reach out to me for advice, it's challenging because you start realizing that you're honestly a little bit too busy. And when someone reaches out like with this open-ended question of like, oh, I want to just get to know your entire story, sometimes you just immediately ignore that because you don't understand where that person is coming from. You have zero context on the call and you just don't have time for it. So it's kind of like that trade-off, right? Like how do you actually get this person's attention, start that conversation, but at the same time, like not make it feel extremely transactional in which you're just going with a bullet list of questions that you're just trying to ask back to back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you worked for one company and now you are the co-founder of XX. Is that right?
Yeah.
One of the co-founders. Yeah. So how did you help start that? Or how did you get the idea or start it? Or What was that like?
Yeah, so we're three partners at this point, and their journey has been pretty, pretty interesting. So for context, XX started an internal project inside WeFunder, and G1, the other founding partner, she used to be head of community at WeFunder when XX got started. And how she did start it was basically like after she learned how little venture capital was going to female founders, she just saw that only 2% was going to women that were starting companies, and she just hated that number. Raised a very small fund only to invest in 6 companies back then, and the check size was $20,000. But I think that was when the magic got started. And we just kept doing it again and again and again and again. Like the beginning used to be with themes. So the first cohort was for female founders. Then we actually transitioned the second cohort to invest in immigrant founders. But after that, we learned that we didn't want to invest in one specific type of people. So for the cohorts after that, we just stopped focusing on those themes. And now we're just investing in the best founders that we come across at the stage that we're interested in.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say XX is like an established fund or an established accelerator or any of that. I think we're still learning a ton. For every single cohort that we do, we change enough things so that we're learning so, so, so much. And we still haven't come across that model that we just want to replicate and replicate all the time. But yeah, I think we're getting closer to that point.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like the fact that you even have a fund and you're helping startups is already like really cool, even if it's not like a huge accelerator or anything like that.
It's the greatest privilege of my life.
Yeah. When did you start? How long has it been going on?
The first cohort started like late 2018. Yeah. So it's
3 years.
Gonna be 2 years and a half. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. And they're all three of you on the side that determines who gets into this accelerator, or are you guys kind of all doing that, or is there one person that really decides?
It's definitely all three of us. Again, I think we're getting to that point in which we're starting to have more defined roles, each one of us.
Mm-hmm.
So personally, my role is I'm the one that focuses a lot more on the fundraising side. So I make sure that we have enough money to invest in startups in the first place and manage the relationship with investors in the fund and raise all the subsequent funds and all that stuff. G1, I think she's kind of like the heart of XX. So she brings a lot of like the personality, the culture, the values. She's the one that kind of like is leading the actual program and the experience that founders have. And then Daniel is more like the lead mentor. He's the one that will be working with every single startup that we invest in, that is more focused on that advice side of things. But when it comes to the decision of which startups we'll pick, it's a process that the three of us are part of.
Mm-hmm. I feel like it's like a college admission. Like you're all in a room, like deciding who gets in, who you want to follow up with.
I think that's 100% true. Because I mean, we're investing in founders that are just getting started, right? So there's not a lot to show for. There's not a ton of metrics. There's a ton of numbers or growth, all of that stuff. Like we like saying that we have like this process of like the founders that we'll end up picking, but a lot of it has to do with this gut instinct of which founders which we have the most conviction for, right? And we try informing that feeling, and we try focusing on different aspects of the founding team alongside the market and the product that they're building. But truly it's like, okay, how do we spot raw talent here? And
mm-hmm.
It's almost at the similar stage of like someone starting college before they go to live their entire lives.
Yeah, it's really similar. There's a lot of parallels. And like I was going to ask, what are some key things that you look at? And I'm sure that there are some key things, but like you said, it's such a gut instinct, and you're dealing with people and you're dealing with companies that haven't started yet. So I'm sure that it's really like a human to human interaction and like gut feeling, not really like, okay, well, they have this metric.
Yeah, for sure.
Are there key things that you look at, or is it really just that like, okay, we're just gonna see like what we feel about it?
No, we do, because again, you don't want to fall into the trap of like, oh, I just feel super strong about this founder or not. Because one, you realize it's just there's so many biases
mm-hmm.
involved in making this kind of decision. Luckily, we're three very different people, so we have three different like we have different kinds of biases, and we're all aware of the ones that we have, but. Some key things that we look at. So again, like we say we want to spot these raw talented founders, but what the hell does that mean? Pragmatically, as we were talking early on, there needs to be someone technical on the team for sure. So many, like most of the startups that apply have someone technical and we won't invest in them. But the opposite is very tricky because when the founding team cannot build at the stage in which we're at, we just personally don't think how we can be useful through 12 weeks. But they need to be super smart. A lot of the founders that we invest in don't have that much traction yet. Like they have some kind of product. Some people are using it. They don't really understand why those people use it. So many times, there's so many different personas in the early adopters and like using it for different reasons. So like the founders cannot even explain why people want what they're building. Many times they're about to launch or they have some users, but it's literally not growing anywhere. So it really doesn't come to that. Obviously, when founders do have traction, et cetera, it's a lot more interesting. There's a lot more stuff that we can talk about and it makes that conversation a bit easier. But honestly, I think it's more challenging to decide to invest in founders when they don't have that to show for. And they may just be like 1 month before that, 2 months before that, but you still want to be the fund that takes them through the 12 weeks and gets them to that point if you actually have conviction for them. So I think it comes to those like non-obvious things of like, okay, the founding team has to be brilliant. They need to be formidable. Many times, even if you don't have a product, it's so easy to just focus on the right things, understand the market that you're going to be working on, and just be extremely informed about it. There's nothing better than reading through an application and learning new things through that application, right? Like you're learning about a new problem, like they're sharing a unique insight on the market that you just never saw before and you can actually agree on, or perhaps not necessarily agree on, but it's interesting enough that you can like you can get convinced or stuff like that. And that leads me to like another market. So many founders are clearly very smart. They're working on interesting stuff, but just the market is non-existent. And in those kinds of scenarios, it's also a very hard decision for us to invest in that company. Because ultimately, if the market is not big enough, there's not that much in free space for founders to experiment, to learn. And ultimately, like they just won't be able to build a huge company, at least not in that market. So they will have to iterate to something else. And in many of those cases, we just choose to not invest, stay in touch, and guide them to that point in which they're getting to a more startup kind of version of what they're trying to build.
Yeah, there's so much that goes into it. And there's so much that can go wrong also. You know, like it's, you can have a good gut feeling or everything can be good on paper and then it just doesn't do well.
But it's interesting because from the fun side of things, that's absolutely true. And you do want to get better in every single decision you make. But ultimately, like the only way funds succeed is by spotting one or two companies that will continue to become like a $1 billion business, right? And like in early stage funds, how that works is like it's a numbers law. So like if you invest in enough startups, making it like knowing how to make those decisions, ultimately you just want to spot one or those like a few companies that will pay for the entire fund so you can ultimately pay back to the investors that believed in you in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not like every single one has to be successful.
For sure. And you get used to that, right? Like it's a weird thing. Like most of the companies you'll invest in 5 years from now are likely to fail. Yeah, it's an interesting, weird thing.
What are some of the biggest mistakes that founders usually make that you've seen working with startups? Like, do you see anything that any big red flags or any mistakes that you're like, okay, like that's definitely something that causes a lot of startups to fail?
Honestly, like there's so many different factors, but the one that comes to mind that to me is pretty interesting is that balance between conviction and stubbornness. Because you need it, right? You need to be stubborn and you need to have a ton of conviction in what you're building. But there's a very thin line that if you pass it, you're in deep trouble. If you find the right balance, like you are where you want to be. And what I mean is if like that thin line is like so many founders are just so stubborn about what they're trying to build to the extent that they're spending months, even years, many times trying to prove to the world that what they're building is that one magical thing that no one else is capable of seeing. Sometimes that is true. Sometimes you need to be opposite to what the herd is saying, but so many more times you're just not seeing what's there for you to understand. Like, you're just not growing, people not really want it and stuff like that. And you have so many different signals and opportunities to take that information, adapt, and just build a different version of where you're trying to get to, or just do something completely different. So when you have that perfect balance of conviction with willingness to adapt, then you are super convicted in what you're trying to build, but ultimately willing to adapt and willing to change. Most of the founders don't have that. Like, a lot of the founders will have a lot of conviction to the point that they're just not taking any information from the outside world and ultimately fail because of themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like with that, it's like you think your idea is the best, as you should, because, you know, you're trying to convince everyone else. But
yeah,
you have to adapt because there's so many things that come your way. I mean, even something like COVID, for example, like that probably rocked a ton of startups. I mean, it completely altered the entire world. But like, I'm sure there's a lot of startups that maybe their business model didn't work anymore because everyone was quarantined, or maybe, you know, they had to pivot their strategy. And I feel like if you're not willing to adapt, then
for sure. And related to that, I think like founders need to not have ego many times, right? Like, you need to be willing to wake up one morning, realize that everything you've been doing is just wrong, and just start again, and do it almost emotionless and not sad about it, because it's part of the journey. You'll have to do it so many times. So it's almost a struggle with yourself and the way you're wired, because we're all like a little bit different, and so many of our weaknesses are just so, so hard to deal with. But it's almost like you need to have so much self-awareness of what those weaknesses are, and not lean to those, but fully lean to the strengths, and just make sure that you're always moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's like a personality trait that a lot of founders have, or do you think anyone can be an entrepreneur?
Great. It's so important. I think the best founders are just cockroaches. I've heard that expression.
I've never heard that before.
But it's just so true. Like, the best founders are just f***ing cockroaches. They'll never give up. Like, ultimately, like, most of the founders, it's not even their fault, but most of the founders will fail because they just choose to fail. The best founders spend so much time just not giving up, just continue to try, willing to adapt for sure, being flexible, willing to learn new things and proving different iterations of where you're trying to get to. But ultimately, like, as long as you keep moving forward, you're onto something, and you're better than most other people. And I think that's a lot of like what execs believes in as well, because we're investing in founders so early on. In so many times, we're gonna be, if not the first check, one of the first checks in these startups. And ultimately, many of them will be first-time founders. Many of them will be just like, obviously all of them are just starting, and it's just a very lonely, hard, mental, challenging journey. So related to that, just having those foundations, having that support system, mentors that will be there when you wake up at 2 a.m. fully lost and you just need to call someone, or a group of founders that actually understand what you're going through, et cetera, that you can rely on and jump on a call once in a while. That's critical, right? Like, mm-hmm. A way to keep that mental sanity through the journey is so important, because ultimately you just don't want to give up. That's the most important thing. So execs is a lot about that. It's not just about great advice. It's not just about focusing, like, help you focus on the right things and accelerate that growth. But it's also just a very human community where you're going to meet other really cool people, and you're going to feel less alone and a little bit more close to other people that actually understand you. I think that's a lot of like what we are trying to focus on execs when it comes to defining our own personality.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I think I've never heard the expression that founders are like cockroaches before, which is funny.
Yeah.
But I do. I get it. And I also think like, a lot of people look at failure as like very bad. Like, it's like, if you fail on one thing, then, you know, you're just a failure in general. And like, you might as well give up now. And I think, like you said, that does set apart like a good founder from a not good founder, like a bad founder.
Yeah. No, I think it needs to be a balance in that sense as well, in which failure is not necessarily something bad.
Yeah.
The moment you fail, that's not the end of your life, but you need to hate failing, right?
Right.
You don't want to fail. And that's also something quite important.
Yeah.
Like, you just don't want to give up. Ultimately, don't spend your entire life building something that people don't give a shit about.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, like, the best founders will just do whatever it takes to not fail if they really believe in something.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that really sets people apart, and people are too quick to give up. And I think that kind of tells something. Like, if you're giving up that quickly, then you probably didn't believe that much in your product to begin with, I feel like. If you give up at the first sign of failure, the first like struggle or hardship.
That could be true. I think it also just goes down to like, there's different kinds of people, right?
Yeah.
Maybe you that was the one thing that you had the most conviction for in your entire life. But you're taking external opinions too seriously. You're taking the feedback from your parents that have nothing, that have no idea what you're onto, like what you're up to and stuff like that. And you just change your opinion. You lose that conviction because of external factors too fast. And that honestly is one of the most dangerous things. I think that's very true for founders when they're in that fundraising stage, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you're capable of losing conviction so fast, and you're talking to so many investors that have no clue of what you're building, really. They only met you for like 30 minutes, 1 hour, and they're saying that no, and you're just taking it, like, don't take it too seriously, you know? Like, obviously, like, fundraising can be a very powerful experience, and it can teach you a lot, but so many founders will just lose complete conviction of what they're building just because they're receiving no after no after no from these investors that perhaps didn't spend a minute trying to really understand what the founders are trying to build, right? And that's a very usual, common way in which founders will end up giving up, because fundraising gets really hard. They don't get money, and they just, yeah, I mean, they lose their way through that. Like, honestly, ultimately, they can fail through different ways, but
yeah. And I mean, a lot of startups obviously are fundraising and need to raise money, or think that they need to raise money. So what are some mistakes you see when people are trying to raise money? Like, or speaking to investors, like, do you see any common mistakes there?
Oh, for sure. A few things. One, you need to be either in fundraising mode or not, right? That's such an important heuristic, because it helps you in so many different ways. One, like, so many investors will have are very opinionated on what you're building. Don't go back after every single investor meeting that gives you feedback and change entirely your product, right? Like, you're in fundraising mode. You'll understand that. You can have a list of all the reasons why investors are choosing not to invest, and make sure that you're optimizing for those. Make sure that your pitch addresses those issues in the story, etc. And that's one thing. Like, too many founders take investor feedback as the most important thing, when it really isn't. The only feedback that matters is the one from users. Two, it's so exhausting. Fundraising, literally, if you're trying to fundraise successfully, it does, and it should take your entire mind space. So when you're trying to fundraise and do something else, it's just very hard, and you're probably not going to do a good job at either of those things. So just make sure that, like, you're giving yourself a specific timeline, 3 months, 6 months, and you're just fundraising there. Like, you may have different goals, but just make sure that at some point, you're only focusing on that. And many times, like, if it drags too long, ultimately just reconsider whether you should be fundraising or not. Too many founders just think of fundraising as the way to prove that their startup is successful, and that's just absolutely not true.
Yeah. Do you think a lot of people raise money that don't necessarily need to raise money, or they're raising too much money, or?
Yeah, I mean, that's probably true for, not sure if most, but a lot of founders. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I feel like it's just common, because we see also, well, one, you hear about it. You're like, this company raised this much money, or their Series A was $100 million or whatever. And you're hearing all of these numbers and all of these startups and these successful companies that are raising money. And then you see shows like Shark Tank, or, you know, things like that. That's like, that's what you think investing is, or talking to investors is like. And I think it can get kind of confusing. Like, you think like, okay, I guess I need to raise money. And like, you kind of just put a price point on it and hope to that helps you. But I think if you don't have a plan, you can have $10 million to grow your company, but if you don't have a plan and you don't have what you're going to do with that company, how you're going to make that money back, like, I feel like it's just not going to work. You know, like, a lot of people, I feel like, do that.
There's so many better things that you could be doing instead of raising money if you don't need the money, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're just starting, if you don't really have something people want, focus on that, right? Like, build product, talk to customers, iterate, understand what people want, and make sure that you're optimizing towards that goal.
It definitely takes up a lot of time, I feel like. And I totally agree that once you're in that mindset, it's really hard to do anything else. Like, you really have to focus on that, because it's like a full-time job just trying to
fundraise. It is a full-time job. Fundraising is not easy. So it definitely should be a full-time job. And the good thing about you being on fundraising mode or not is that ultimately, if you are, you'll make sure to finish it as quickly as possible, so that ultimately you can go back to those things that matter more.
Yeah.
If not, you're just dragging it along.
What are some tips that you have for like getting in front of angel investors or VCs, or, you know, like if you're just, let's say you don't have the connections already, how do you smart network, like kind of like we were talking about, and actually get yourself in front of them?
It's hard, right? Sadly, like network is like fundraising and being connected to investors, just one other example of those that are a little bit more privileged than everyone else, right? So honestly, you just need to carve your way through a lot of like cold. I don't know. I think for founders that don't have a network of investors, probably their best superpower in that case is just other founders that they know. Like not all founders know investors and are very well connected in that way. Most founders have other friends that are also founders. And in a lot of scenarios, those other founders have raised money in the past and know some investors, right? So if you don't have that network, the best way to build it is through other founders that you already know. And ask those founders that believe in you to get introduced to the investors that believed in them, kind of thing. And if you don't even have that, if you don't have a network of founders, building a network of founders is much easier than building a network of investors, right?
Mm-hmm. Totally. And also, I mean, I think with reaching out to people, it obviously helps if you know people already, but there are now so many ways that you can reach out and form connections on your own. I think like you can form connections by LinkedIn, you can form connections on social media, even, I mean, emailing. Like, I think that now the world has gotten a lot smaller and it's easier to reach out and like form those connections. And even in your community or your college or, you know, just asking, now is the time to like ask people that like you think might know someone to like set up that intro.
No, that is absolutely true. Typically, we believe we have a worse network than the one we really do. Mm-hmm. There's always an entry door. If you're shameless and are unwilling to burn all bridges when it's necessary, you're always going to find that entry door. I 100% agree with that. I just think that like in terms of like practical advice, just like, I'm sure you know other founders, and those founders probably know a ton of investors, at least one of them do. Mm-hmm. And that's just the best way to get an intro email to an investor that will take it seriously. Because if you also think about it, investors are getting so much inbound and cold emails. An investor will take a warm intro from a founder they already invested in to meet another founder a lot more seriously than this random person just reaching out to them out of nowhere, right? So it's probably going to be a lot more effective than just sending like this cold message via LinkedIn or stuff like that directly to them.
Definitely. And what are you excited to see more of in the future? What do you hope to see more of in the future in terms of startups?
I'll answer it at a personal level, but it's a tricky question because I hate social media. And I've, like, before I started XX, like in my mind, like if a few years ago you asked me, like, what are you going to build? Now I'm building XX, but before, like if I would have just started my own company, I always said like, I wanted to redefine social media and stuff like that. So I was always like extremely passionate about that because I just knew how toxic it was in my own personal life, that I kind of like, I have a very weird relationship with these apps. Like I delete them, I download them, and so many times I'm spending like tens of hours more than I should. And other times I'm just trying to stay as far away as possible from them. So I definitely think that social media just has become like a huge component of our lives. Mm-hmm. And I wish we could find alternatives in which we can have a healthier relationship with them or gain a little bit more real value from the way we use them. So I was always interested about that. But typically when founders are trying to do that these days, honestly, it's the ones that are least believing because it's such a hard problem. And once you learn a little bit more about like human nature and all of that stuff, it almost feels like an impossible thing to avoid. Like it's ultimately like how people are wired, this idea of like being mindless and all that stuff. Like it's a lot of like things that we actually want. Mm-hmm. Like so many more times we want to be mindless and not really present and stuff like that. And you ultimately learn that you need to develop like your own self habits of like, how do you develop that healthy relationship with social media in the first place? But I mean, if someone is actually having like a very brilliant, noble approach to the way social media has been built and is building like a version that actually does that and understands all of that aspect of human nature and habits and is using that for a better version of what's currently out there, I would be extremely intrigued.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, healthier social media.
Yeah, someone to fix social media.
Yeah. Did you watch the social, or what is it called? The Netflix documentary on social media. I forgot what it's called.
Yeah. No, the one of Cambridge Analytica.
Yes. I was like,
it's insane.
Oh my God. They literally.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're controlled by them. Like,
no, they
like
for sure.
Totally know what we're going to do, what we like. I mean, I get so many like targeted ads on Instagram and like, they know exactly what to show me. They know exactly what I need to purchase. And it's honestly mm-hmm. very scary. I've set limits on myself. So I have like limits on my iPhone now on how long yeah. I can spend on social media.
Yeah.
And I really try my best to stick to it.
For sure. It's a very scary thing.
Yeah.
It's a very scary thing.
Yeah, totally. And what's another industry, I guess, that you would say the XX is excited about?
Yeah. So that was more like at a personal level, because honestly, like most of the startups that apply are trying to redefine social, like honestly, that's a very challenging market. And
right.
most likely they don't have a unique insight and most likely they have a very hard time ahead. At an XX level, I think like, I just like when founders are working on something that is just non-obvious, right? Mm-hmm. They're like when you have so many founders that are applying to the program, you obviously realize about specific trends. Or most of the founders are working on very similar things that are like the conversation at a much larger scale, right? So one is like redefining social media or stuff like that, and that's like the easiest path founders can go to. But it's just so f-ing cool when you come across this startup that is trying to solve a very non-obvious, like a problem that only you discover when you're facing it yourself or because of their own life experience or because they spent a lot of time trying to discover an interesting market or an interesting problem that they want to work on. And it's just cool, right? Like, I don't know. There's no specific industry. XX is not focused on anything in particular. Mm-hmm. But obviously, if you're working on something that is a lot more novel, a lot more non-obvious, and just something that people are not necessarily talking about quite yet, then obviously you have some kind of advantage versus everyone else that is trying to solve for the same one thing.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Before we go, what is some of your best advice that you would give to a startup that's applying to an accelerator program or kind of just starting out and they're a first-time founder? Like, what's some of your best advice?
I think the best advice for that is ultimately not related to that. It's more focused on just make sure you're building focus on building the company and focus on the right things. And if that's clearly true, that will come across in anything that you're doing, in a conversation with investors, in a conversation with future employees or stuff like that. So when you're just starting, going back to that idea of networking, there's just so much noise. There's mm-hmm. so many things that you could be doing. And honestly, only a few of them are actually the correct ones that you should be focusing on. So focus on those. Make sure that you're building this system, this process towards product market fit, and are really trying to be mindful about what people want. And it's such a overstated phrase, but it's still so important because you need to be working towards that goal. Ultimately, like the only way a startup will truly grow is if you build something people want in a market that is big enough for your company to grow to incredible sizes. So have that process, try learning from that system, try gathering data, try like discovering new things through that journey, and just ruthlessly focus on what gets people excited about what you're trying to build. Make sure you're getting feedback from the right places. Make sure you're getting the right users. When you only have 10, you want 10 valuable users, not 10 users that just were the first 10 people that said, yeah, I'm happy to use that product kind of thing. Just be ruthlessly focused on the things that matter to you. Be happy to like ignore some users that were the first adopters because they don't add as much value as that one specific person that you always had in mind. Make sure that you're not taking a feedback from people that don't really understand your company too seriously. Maybe it's an investor, maybe it's just one mentor. So many, like you spent so many hours, hundreds of hours thinking about the idea that you're trying to solve for. Either mentors or investors will only spend like 30 minutes tops trying to really comprehend the same worldview that you have, and obviously they won't get it that fast. Mm-hmm. So obviously they have a lot of advice, but focus on the generic advice, perhaps not on those comments as like, oh, I don't really believe in this, you should be doing something else kind of thing.
Right.
And find people that will support you through that journey as well.
Yeah, that's great advice. I mean, I think that a lot of people can apply that. Thanks for sharing that. And where can they find the XX? When's your next? I know the application's just closed, but do you do 1 a year, 2 a year? What does that look like?
Yeah. So again, I was going back to like, we're just starting. We used to do the batches every 9 months. Now we're doing them every 4 months. We're probably going to continue doing that. So the applications for the next batch just closed last week. We're probably going to open them again in October. But if you want to be up to date, there's two ways in which you can know that. One, follow us on Twitter, which is _XXteam, or just subscribe to our newsletter, which you'll find in our website, xx.team. And we'll definitely let people know there whenever we're opening the next applications.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on my podcast.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of The Real Real. I hope that you enjoyed, and don't forget to rate, review, follow, or subscribe on your favorite podcast app. You can follow me personally on Instagram at Natalie Barbu and the podcast at The Real Real Podcast. I'll see you next Monday.
Hey there, my name is Renee Rina, and I am the mom friend you have always wanted. I am also the host of the Mom Room podcast. We publish 2 episodes per week, a co-hosted episode on Tuesdays and a solo episode on Thursdays. Popular topics include pooping and having sex after giving birth. I have a solo episode where I talk about not sharing a bed with my husband and why that's okay. I hope you'll tune in to these conversations every week. Join us on Instagram at the Mom Room Podcast and start to feel a little less alone in this crazy thing called motherhood.